KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Dr. Virginia Crisp of Middlesex University, London, who is going to be discussing her work that she is doing on the character, although he is a real human being, known as Kim.com. I met Virginia at MIT 8, a communications scholars conference at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology a few weeks ago. And I saw her presentation entitled Kim.com's Mega, Political Activism or Self-Promotion. And listening to that presentation and being familiar with Kim.com, as many listeners here are, and I will introduce him to you, and Virginia will discuss him in detail for those that aren't, I thought this was exactly the kind of topic that we should be talking about in Hearsay Culture, and indeed that we have talked about in Hearsay Culture from time to time. Kim.com, for those of you that aren't familiar, was the founder of the what amounts to a cyber locker website known as Mega Upload. And Mega Upload was a website that became quite notorious within the last couple of years because of the volume of copyright infringement or piracy, depending on your perspective, that was going on this website. .com, and again, he changed his name to this. So when we say .com, normally we'd be thinking of a website, but for purposes of this interview, we're talking about a human being. .com founded Mega Upload, and according to research that Virginia did, the accusations involve the revenues totaling $500 million over 5 years. According to Virginia's work, citing an article in The Guardian from last year, one of the executives of a company that accounted for 4% of total internet traffic, he was an executive of, and he shared in profits of over $175 million as a result of copyright infringing activities. These are large sums. Recent history of copyright infringement or piracy has been one that has focused heavily on illegal downloads. It focused on things like torrents, where people were aggregating bits of information in order to rapidly grab information and grab MP3s and grab other copyrighted content, focused on things like peer-to-peer networking, which was and remains a technology where there is no central middle person or middleman, and so it's very difficult to trace where files are coming from. But the current battle is really over, and things will change within the next year or two as well, but the current battle is over these cyber lockers, where people are just storing data in the cloud, as it were, on websites like Mega Upload, and a lot of the files and data and content that is stored there is, in fact, copyright-infringing material, although there is legitimate uses of these technologies as well, which continues to vex courts and policymakers deciding what to do with these issues. But in Mega Upload and Kim.com, we're dealing with something quite different, and this is an individual that who I will leave for description by Virginia, but who is needless to say quite colorful, and also very famously was arrested by authorities both in New Zealand, where he is from and where he was located, as well as authorities from the United States through the form of the FBI. And .com made himself a martyr, as it were, of this movement, whatever that is, which we'll talk about as well. And in relaunching a website known as Mega, he almost made light of those issues, but also elevated himself, at least in his own mind, and we'll talk about whether this means anything, to something more than merely a copyright infringer or pirate, and started speaking of issues involving privacy and internet surveillance, and a lot of the core issues that many internet technologists and fans think of when they think about what makes the internet so useful. So there's a lot to talk about here, and I'm excited to have Virginia on as someone who is focusing her current work on .com and someone who could speak about these issues in more detail. So we are going to spend this show talking about Mega Upload and Kim.com. By way of brief background, Virginia is a PhD from Goldsmiths College, University of London. She has her master's in film studies and a bachelor's in social and cultural studies with film studies. Interestingly, her research interests explore the relationship between formal and informal distribution of East Asian cinema. And her research interests include not only digital piracy, but also file sharing, copyright, cultural industries, and digital research methods. She's the author of several articles. She is joining us via Skype on May 22nd, and the show is airing on that day, so it works nicely. She's joining us from her home in North London, and I appreciate you joining us today, Virginia, on Hearsay Culture. Thanks for taking the time.
No, thanks. It's great to be here.
Let's start off with a question that I ask virtually everyone on the show, and I'll ask you as well. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you decided to focus on Kim.com.
Well, as you sort of so neatly introduced, my background is really all about film, and my main research is really about the distribution of film. And as you say, the formal and informal sort of modes of distribution. And for those terms, we have Ramon Lobato, Australian theorist, to thank. We could replace formal and informal with legal and illegal, but formal and informal are less value-laden and also a bit more inclusive terms. And so I've been interested in how distribution really, is certainly in the film sector anyway, controls our access to films, our access to culture. And so with the growth of different forms of digital piracy and online forms of distribution, I thought it was really important to study how these things change our relationship with films and change our position potentially as audiences. And through all of that, I've actually been studying online file sharing communities that generally share files using BitTorrent and eDonkey. And during that time, I noticed, as you mentioned, the rise of cyberlockers and one-click web hosting as a new form of digital piracy that was very different to the form of exchange that was going on before, because certainly in the communities I've been looking at, they were very based on a sort of reciprocal version of exchange of files. So you could really call it file sharing proper, I suppose, without wanting to romanticize it too much. And I think we have to be critical of what people say about themselves, but within a lot of the communities I was studying at the time, there was a big emphasis on sharing over theft and personal gain, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all sorts of stuff going on there. And as you said, there was this growth in cyber lockers that was sort of happening at the same time. So as soon as sort of I started publishing research, it became pretty much out of date as this new form of piracy started to evolve. And so my interest in Kim.com sort of existed in the background. And obviously I was aware of mega uploads and when they were shut down quite dramatically in January 2012. But it wasn't my focus until this year, in January, when .com launched Mega, his new cyberlocker, cloud storage platform, whatever you want to call it. And the way this was launched was very, very dramatic, very flamboyant, as is sort of quite commonplace for .com, really. And that really sparked my interest because essentially it was all over the UK press. And while piracy and illegal downloading is often in the press in the UK and I'm sure in the US as well, it's not normally accompanied by any sort of knowledge of a figurehead. There might be things like the Swedish Pirate Bay, but quite often the people behind that don't become the story, as it were. Whereas what I was seeing with the launch of Mega was that Kim.com, partially through his own sort of design, was becoming the story rather than the company or the potential for piratical practices, shall we say. And the launch was very dramatic. It took place at .com's house in New Zealand, or I should probably say his mansion in New Zealand. And it sort of started with some music from a Maori group. Then it turned into a sort of stand-up comedy act. And then the thing that really interested me was .com came on and gave a speech. And this speech was much less about Mega, this new company, and much, much more about internet privacy, government control and conspiracy, and how the internet was basically being taken away from us, including .com, and how basically signing up to Mega, this new company, was a way of reacting against this form of government and corporate control. And this is what I found really, really interesting in what .com was talking about, basically.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, as I should say here, you're not a lawyer, and so it's interesting to me, which is okay, by the way, that isn't viewed as a negative, to be clear. But it's interesting. You mentioned referring to this as formal and informal, so as to not have as much value overlay. Perhaps you could talk more about what you mean there. What do you mean by formal and informal, and what is the value judgment or value metric that is absent in those terms?
Well, I think the reason that formal and informal are terms I prefer is because they allow you to include things within informal distribution that are illegal and legal, should we say. So you could argue, you could make a very strong case that selling pirate DVDs, exchanging files on the internet is a form of illegal distribution. But when you get into sort of film clubs where people get together and they potentially charge a pound or a dollar entry, and they're showing a film that they don't have the rights to show, that is illegal, but is it as illegal as profiting off these practices? And as you say, I'm not a lawyer, and so I'm not particularly, well, it's not necessarily right to say I'm not concerned about whether something is illegal or legal, but I'm not primarily concerned with that. That's not my particular focus. I'm interested in how we engage with culture. And so the terms formal and informal allow me to differentiate between a kind of industrial mode of distribution that is potentially focused on commercial concerns and profit, and more sort of informal forms of distribution that are actually focused on access, community engagement, and sort of having a relationship with texts rather than sort of circulating them for commercial gain, essentially.
So, Virginia, when we think about these issues, and again, really to frame this discussion, right? The logical place to start is with Kim.com himself. You use the term in the presentation. I saw you use the term micro celebrity, and so I want you to define that. But before we even get to that, that's really the second question. The first is, who is this guy? What do we know about him? And it's not that he's a secret individual, but perhaps you could describe him not only demographically, but just who we're dealing with.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he's far from a private person in many respects. He's very flamboyant. He's very outgoing. And I mean, you could almost say that there are two .coms that I'm kind of concerned with, the one before the shutdown of Mega Upload and the one afterwards. But to give you a little bit of background, he's originally from Germany, and I believe he was born Kim Schmidt, but he now lives in New Zealand for various reasons. It's been reported, certainly in the UK press, that he has a history as a hacker, and that in 1998 he was sentenced to 2 years for theft of both money and trade secrets from banks and utility companies. He was also generally famed for his interest in guns and cars. There are lots of sort of, you know, if you Google .com, you find lots of images of him holding guns, driving fast cars, standing next to yachts and beautiful women and that kind of stuff. And for instance, at the press conference for Mega, he came on and he was flanked by about six or eight women dressed in what can possibly be described as sort of sexy French World War II resistance costumes. should we say. So he's definitely a very flamboyant figure, and he's interested in money, excess, at least in the way he presents himself. But then what I'm kind of suggesting is that a lot of this changed after the shutdown of Mega Upload. And he self-consciously, I believe, although it's always difficult to tell, tried to rework his persona. So it was less the kind of millionaire playboy and much more the internet activist, someone who is representing our interests as sort of internet users against the sort of government control and corporate control of the internet.
So then, you know, as we get into who he is, right, what is this concept of the micro-celebrity that plays a role in your research and in how you view him and ultimately why we should even care?
Mm. Well, I think this concept of micro-celebrity is quite a useful one, because what it allows us to understand is the way that branding and self-promotion is increasingly becoming part of all of our lives. So broadly speaking, it's the idea that using platforms like Twitter and Facebook, we all end up performing some sort of celebrity. And so to a greater or lesser extent, we are all micro-celebrities, shall we say. But that also involves us thinking about what we actually mean by this term celebrity. So I'm thinking about celebrity and fame as something that isn't something you either have or you don't have. It's something that exists on a continuum. So we all perform celebrity at various points in our lives. This is highlighted by things like Facebook and Twitter, where we self-consciously perform celebrity. But also, you know, as a lecturer in a university, as a school teacher, you know, or even, you know, with friends in a bar, you perform your own identity, and you might perform that like a celebrity does by carefully crafting a particular persona. Now, the concept of micro-celebrity allows us to see people as performing celebrity in particular ways. So we view our friends in the kind of Facebook sense of friends as fans. And the important thing as well is that popularity is the goal of these kind of practices. So not only do we conceive of our friends as our fans, we're also consciously trying to increase our popularity with them. And potentially the most important thing is that the self is produced as a product. So the persona is carefully crafted and then sold to a theoretical audience.
We're chatting with Dr. Virginia Crisp of Middlesex University London on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Virginia, you know, let me ask this. You've kind of answered it, but, you know, given that we're talking about one individual, who's flamboyant, who's, you know, certainly someone who craves media attention, I am compelled to ask this somewhat harsh question, mm-hmm. but a question I think is relevant, which is, okay, why should we care? Why spend, put aside my show, why spend your time studying this individual? What can, you know, in terms of looking at him, what can we get out of the practice, and the time put into studying one guy?
I think it's a really important and perfectly valid question. I mean, I think the problem is that he is associating himself with a particular debate, shall we say. And he's also constructing the debate over internet piracy and corporate control and the activities of companies like Facebook and Google as being something that he is heading a movement against. And I would argue that there are many movements that are concerned with this particular issue, but there's no one movement that he is heading. Also, he's mentioned in articles alongside characters like Aaron Swartz and also the hacker group Anonymous, who have quite recently publicly criticized .com. And for me, this is all quite highly problematic, because in the absence of other figureheads for a movement that may or may not exist, he is positioning himself as speaking for us. And even since I've started this research, he's changed the front of his website, and his lawyers have released a white paper, and he says the government versus you in brackets Kim.com. So he's saying that he speaks for me. He's saying he speaks for you. He's saying he speaks for all of us. And therefore, I think it is important to consider and critique what he is actually saying potentially in my name. Because for me, it seems quite clear that whatever his political leanings or motivations, his goal is actually to promote himself and his commercial interests. That's not to say he doesn't believe passionately in what he's doing. That's not particularly for me to say. But he is saying explicitly that subscribing to Mega, signing up to his cloud storage service, is a political statement. But to my mind, what he's offering is a sense of empowerment rather than actual power. And I think this is a bit of a problem. Also, I would equate the way that Mega is being branded to the way other companies brand themselves. And in particular, I'm starting to think about how it relates to a concept of greenwashing. That is the idea of presenting company practices as somehow green when they actually have another agenda. The most sort of famous example being towels in hotel rooms. You're always given a little note that says, please reuse your towels to save the environment, as though that is the primary purpose of the activity, not to actually save the hotel some money. So BP, for instance, British Petroleum, quite a good example as well, have a lovely logo that looks like a flower in green and yellow, deliberately designed to associate the company with nature, purity, simplicity. And this is obviously a diversionary tactic to focus on the nice aspects of the company and away from the oil spills and the billion-dollar profits. And so I think .com is doing a very similar thing. He's first of all presenting himself as reflecting my interests, and so therefore I want to know in what way he is trying to present me and myself. But also I think there's quite obviously an element of, obviously not greenwashing, but branding going on, where we're being sold this sense of empowerment. We're being told that by signing up to a company, this is a form of political action. And if we're told that signing up to a company is a political action, then what repercussions does this have on actual political life and political participation?
Now, .com, and by way of last really background question on him, again, for those that aren't familiar, he rather flamboyantly was prosecuted. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that prosecution, both in terms of the procedure that was used, which was controversial, to many, and then the substance to get us up to where we are today.
Well, I must admit, that's a little bit more difficult for me because, as you're saying,
yeah.
I'm not a lawyer.
Right. I don't mean it in terms of what the law that he was violating, but more in terms of what literally happened, because it certainly was big news in New Zealand, mm-hmm. but I don't think it quite translated the same way here.
Okay. Well, in January 2012, basically, over the course of about 48 hours, a combination of things happened. All of Megalo upload servers were seized by the FBI. I think most of them, although they were in more than one place, most of them were in the west coast of North America, I believe. The houses of all of the executives were raided. Most prominently, .com's was raided in New Zealand. The details about this are a little sketchy because the people who raided the house and .com himself have conflicting accounts of what actually happened. Some say that he was hiding in his safe room, a sort of panic room kind of place. Other people suggest that he was sort of standing there open-armed, just waiting for the FBI, and was very amenable and helpful with all of their inquiries. So it's a little bit grey what actually happened on that day. What certainly did happen is that .com didn't know they were coming. They did come in with sort of helicopters, and certainly on New Zealand television, there was some quite interesting footage from a press helicopter that was sort of going in at the same time. And so it was quite a dramatic raid. you know, SWAT team coming in over the roof, basically giving him no time to potentially get rid of documentation. .com has subsequently said that there were legal issues with this, that the FBI did not have permission to raid his home in that way and to seize his servers in that way, and that all of this essentially has been done illegally. So he's claimed quite vocally that all of the incidents surrounding the seizure of Mega Upload's sort of servers, and then therefore, of course, the files of all of the people who signed up to Mega Upload, whether they be legal or illegal files, that there was a problem with this seizure. Basically, it was illegal, and the FBI did not have permission, let alone permission to actually raid .com's home in the way that they did.
We're chatting with Virginia Crisp, doctor at the University, at Middlesex University London, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know, it is on KZSU FM, Stanford University, that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our website and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you continue to listen to KZSU. So, you know, one of the issues here, and again, this is why, you know, a good amount of background here is important, Virginia, is that, as I mentioned, this was big news in New Zealand. And having been in New Zealand late last year, I was even surprised at how many people were very familiar, intimately familiar with Kim.com. Of course, it's a certainly much smaller country than the United States. And as you mentioned, there was a lot of law enforcement activity there. But perhaps you mentioned that he became and lives in New Zealand for a variety of reasons. Perhaps, again, to contextualize who this person is before we get into your take on what it means, why was he in New Zealand? And perhaps you could describe the pirate culture there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason he's in New Zealand is because, and this seems to be sort of bearing out in reality, it's quite difficult to extradite him from New Zealand. Also, New Zealand, and certainly the New Zealand government and businesses, seem to be embracing .com. I mean, obviously, he is an extremely wealthy man, and he has lots of high-profile commercial interests, so you can see why they would be interested in him. Why New Zealand over, say, the UK or something like that? I think if he was in the UK, he would probably have been extradited by now. And certainly I don't think the UK government would have put so much backing behind him and supported him so much. That's not to say that the New Zealand legal system is being lenient upon him, but that was obviously the reason for him moving, particularly to New Zealand. I must admit, I don't actually know that much about New Zealand pirate culture. This work is very much at its infancy. And so I've been really focusing so far on how .com presents himself. And what I'm going to move on to doing, hopefully quite soon, is thinking about how is he then actually received. I mean, at the moment, gauging his popularity is very difficult. I mean, certainly anyone I speak to in the UK really doesn't know who he is. Even people that know quite a lot about piracy aren't necessarily that aware of him. I wouldn't like to necessarily cite Twitter as a perfect measure of popularity, mm-hmm. but he has just under 300,000 followers on Twitter, which is a lot for an average person. But, you know, compared to someone like Justin Bieber, who's got about 38 million, it's absolutely negligible. So it's very difficult to tell how prominent he actually is. I do get the sense he's very prominent in New Zealand, but not so much so anywhere else. That is until the launch of Mega, when in the UK he started getting an awful lot of press coverage in a way that he simply hadn't before.
So let's turn more broadly to your take on this, on piracy itself. And then perhaps I'll just ask this broad question, and then we can drill down a bit. So what is your take on copyright piracy as a social good or bad? We talked a little bit about that at the beginning, but perhaps you can now dig in a little bit more to contextualize your own perspective on this research.
Mm. I mean, I think it's a really difficult question, but equally a really important one. But I would say I think it's impossible to argue whether it is socially good or bad. And I will give a much fuller answer. That's not just evading the question. But I think there's a couple of things going on here. Really, when we're asking whether something's good or bad, we're asking a moral question. And while it's perfectly reasonable to make moral judgments in some respects, what quite often happens within these debates is a kind of a conflation of the immoral with the illegal. So quite often people assume that just because something is illegal that it is also immoral. And so I would be hesitant to make broad claims about whether things are good or bad. Nonetheless, there are obviously repercussions in certain ways. And I think it's really interesting that you ask about it from a particularly social angle, because so often the debate is about things like how much money is lost through piracy and file sharing, or more specifically, why are people breaking the law? If people know that this is illegal, why is everyone engaging in this illegal practice? But I'm actually a lot more interested in this sort of social question. So in order to think about whether it's socially good or bad, I'm much more interested in thinking about how does this new form of dissemination, of distribution of film or music or software alter our relationship with the kind of cultural text itself? Does it make us a producer of a text with, when we have practices like fan subbing, which you get in film distribution quite a lot, where basically groups of people will get together in order to provide subtitles for films that aren't available in their own languages. What will quite often happen is people will provide subtitles in a, shall we say, relatively dominant language like English, and then people will take the English subtitles and then translate them into French, Spanish, Portuguese, etc. So I like thinking about how these various practices change the way we engage with things. We could also think about whether it actually file sharing makes us a distributor. Now, with things like cyber lockers, this may be less of an issue, but certainly with the kind of BitTorrent type of file sharing that kind of enforces you to upload almost as much as you download, does this change our relationship to media, being one where we sort of passively consume it, to one where we actively remix it, remake it, review it, change it, and distribute it? And I'm also interested in ideas about whether it gives us greater access to a wider or more vibrant culture. So I think this is where we might go back to this idea of, is this a social good or a social bad? When we're thinking about, yes, there may be economic costs, but do those economic costs bring with them social benefits, broadly speaking? You know, if piracy in China enables people, to take one particular example, enables people to engage with texts that are normally censored by the government, then that is potentially a social good. But then, of course, if that then has the repercussion of, you know, damaging the Chinese film industry, then that could be a social bad. So I'm interested really in how these practices of piracy, dissemination, etc., basically give power to consumers or change the game somewhat. But I think it's also important to think about in this question, is copyright piracy a social good or a social bad? To also think about the fact that we can't really talk about copyright piracy in any kind of uniform sense, because actually there's loads and loads of different forms of piracy, A lot of people make a distinction between piracy and file sharing, for instance. Certainly the groups of file sharers that I interviewed for my PhD research consider themselves to be file sharers and considered pirates to be other people. Pirates were people who made profit out of illegal distribution. File sharers were people who circulated things in a non-profit way. Now, I think there could be problematic reasons for making those distinctions, but nonetheless, they were quite prominent distinctions in the communities I spoke to. So I think it's important to think about that we're not talking about a uniform activity. We might be talking about small, closed communities sharing files within a group of 30 people. We might talk about the activities of mega upload, which are obviously very, very different. We might think about something like Nollywood, the Nigerian film industry, and there's a really interesting article, might even be a book actually, by Brian Larkin about how the systems of distribution for film within Nollywood, within Nigeria, are actually intertwined. So pirate channels release official DVDs and official DVDs are released through pirate channels and vice versa. So you can't really separate these systems. And then again, of course, piracy also includes DVDs in street markets, but it might also include, as I kind of suggested earlier, more informal forms of illegality where people sort of get together in film clubs. And so it's very difficult to actually make broad judgments about whether piracy is socially good or socially bad, just as much as it's very difficult to make strict definitions about whether it is economically good or bad because of the varying different forms of piracy that takes place. It's also then dependent on various sort of geographical and political contexts. Also at this conference that we were at MIT, there was a speaker, Jingying Li, and she's written a really interesting article on the debuffs in China. And these are basically film aficionados. And she makes the argument that the debuffs in China through piracy are actually generating a vibrant cinephile culture, one that encourages people to be filmmakers as much as film pirates. And so she's talking about a really productive form of piracy that obviously produces a social good, ultimately. But then that's just one form of piracy. It's very, very different, and it's in a specifically Chinese context where films are otherwise very, very tightly controlled and censored. And that's very, very different to people sitting in a bedroom in the UK or in the US and downloading, you know, the latest episode of Homeland or, you know, 30 Rock or something like that just because they don't want to wait for it to happen. And so I think in answer to your question, it's almost impossible to say overall whether copyright piracy is socially, economically good or bad, because it's varied. And I think it has to be looked at in a lot more detail as it is being, but also it can never be considered as one uniform activity because, exactly as you pointed out at the beginning, the forms of piracy we see now are different to the ones we saw a couple of years ago, and they will ultimately change again in 6 months, a year, 2 years from now.
We're chatting with Dr. Virginia Crisp of Middlesex University, London, on KZSU FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. So, Virginia, one of the quotes that you mentioned in the presentation I saw is a quote from that launch of .com's new website, Mega. And I want to read the quote and then ask your reaction to it. .com said, "By using Mega, you say no to those who want to know everything about you. By using Mega, you say no to governments that want to spy on you. And by using Mega, you are saying yes to internet freedom and your right to privacy." Now, anyone who, is around political communication, anyone who lives in countries where people run for office, this could easily be dismissed as self-styled claptrap designed to present an image and nothing more. But is that right? I mean, do you think it's appropriate to dismiss this as merely salesmanship, as you say in the title of your piece, right? Is this person a political activist, or is it merely self-promotion?
I think it's really important to engage with it. And I think in some ways, as I've been thinking about this, I would probably argue that it is both self-promotion and political activism in a way, because the problem is working out what is political activism and what isn't. There is this sort of this concept of clicktivism. It's the idea that increasingly actual political activism is being replaced by just liking something on Facebook. So that's not really political participation. That's just liking something on Facebook. That doesn't really change the world. But then there's also a reaction against this that says, well, who are you to define what political participation actually is? If clicking like on Facebook is some form of empowerment for an individual, then who are we to decide or dismiss it as, you know, pointless? And I think that obviously .com is trying to equate these things and is trying to promote himself and his company. But I think it's important that we don't dismiss it for some of the reasons that I mentioned earlier. Most notably being, he is presenting it as almost a replacement for other forms of political participation. And whilst we could get into a debate about what is political participation, I think it's also important to think about people who claim to represent our interests. And obviously politicians claim to represent our interests, and we're quite critical of them. And it would be very, very easy to dismiss .com. But I think until we actually understand, and this is where I hope to go with the research, until we actually understand what kind of influence he is having on people, if any, potentially, then we can't dismiss him as a kook, as a conspiracy theorist, as a crazy person, as a self-promotionist, because actually what he's claiming to do is represent our interests. And he's got a lot of power, he's got a lot of money, and he's got a lot of influence in some ways. And so I think we have to be critical of him. And his message is clear. If you sign up to Mega, you take a stand for internet freedom. And what I think I need to further investigate is, well, is this giving people a sense of empowerment whereby they therefore then go out and engage in other forms of political activism? Or is this replacing political activism? And this is why I think this issue needs to be considered in a lot more depth, because of this engagement with politics, because of its potential replacement or encouragement of other forms of political participation. I mean, certainly my sense now at the moment, at this stage of the research, is that what Mega is offering is empowerment without power. And this does concern me. And so I think in many respects, it's being branded like Nike. You know, Nike says we can just do it. So therefore we get a sense that if we wear Nike trainers, we will be sporty, we will be healthy, etc. It's selling us that. We're quite aware of that, and that's fine. And I think Mega is being branded in just the way Nike is. Nike says just do it. Mega says take a stand against corporate control of the internet. But again, it comes back to, are we being empowered? Does that empowerment lead to actual political action and change? Are we actually being offered power, or is this just, you know, a substitute and a poor one at that?
So in the remaining 7 or 8 minutes, which is what we have left, Virginia, I do what I call the unfair questions portion of the interview, okay. Particularly in an area like this where there's a lot of context and a fair amount of complexity. I'm going to ask you questions that you may not feel comfortable answering in full, but nonetheless I ask them because, well, it's my show, and because we use the time anyway. So, you know, when, as I was, you know, thinking about who Kim.com is and his relevance, I was struck particularly with these quotes at parallels to another high-profile internet activist of sorts, and that's Julian Assange. Now, I think clearly, or maybe you disagree with this, clearly Assange, in terms of his impact, is far more, both the impact is greater, and I think the risks associated with his behavior are greater from a governmental standpoint, but there's also potentially upsides, at least to the extent that, in my view, we rethink what secrets are and what secrecy is needed and what secrecy is not, among other things, as a result of as a result of Assange. But I'm curious to get your take on that. I mean, are there fair parallels between .com and Assange, particularly in light of how .com presents himself, or is that a bridge too far?
I'm not sure it's quite a bridge too far. I think there are potential parallels. I think .com would probably certainly like there to be parallels. And so it's always potentially possible that the parallels we might draw might be almost by the design of .com and his PR machine, which I assume to exist. Having said that, taking it at face value as much as I can at the moment, I think actually while there are parallels in terms of the way .com is presenting himself, to tell the truth, to give us the truth about the mega upload scandal, to tell us the truth about government and corporate control, I think that there are fundamental differences between Kim.com's website and WikiLeaks, obviously, and also .com and Assange for varying reasons. One is that WikiLeaks actually contained information. One of the quite obvious things about Kim.com's website, which is incidentally Kim.com, is that there is actually very little content on the website. There is information about what was allegedly wrong with the arrest and the shutdown of Mega Upload. And there is also, recently within the last couple of weeks, the white paper that has been put up there. So there's more information. But there's not very much, and certainly not much in comparison to something like WikiLeaks. But I think the fundamental difference between these two characters is to do with the fact that .com wasn't particularly interested, at least publicly interested, in internet freedom before the shutdown of Mega Upload. And so you can see that his activism, such as it is centered around himself in a lot of ways. Whereas WikiLeaks almost operated in a different way, because WikiLeaks itself was leaking information, and then Assange became the story. You could also argue that Kim.com has become the story, but he is creating himself as the story, putting himself as the figurehead of the story, making himself this central person, as opposed to Assange, ignoring the complexities of the non-leak related legal complications of the Assange case. I think they are coming from different places. .com was not publicly concerned about internet freedom before Mega Upload was shut down, and now it's become central to his whole PR strategy. So I see .com's truth-telling, as it were, to be quite localized. It's really just about what happened to Mega Upload. If you go there, there's not really detail about what internet freedom is being eroded. Now, obviously, there are big debates about internet freedom and what attacks on our privacy, but there's no real information on .com's website, as opposed to WikiLeaks, which was, you know, hub of information, too much information, and very difficult to sift through. So I think actually the parallels that could be made are probably from the design of .com rather than because of any actual connections between these two individuals.
So, Virginia, in the remaining couple of minutes that we have, I do want to ask you. So, what is his current status? I mean, what is Mega doing? What is he doing? I'm not asking you to take out a crystal ball, but rather I'd like to ask you as the follow-up, and what are you doing, as you mentioned a few times, to continue to follow him in your own research. So where is Mega, and what are you going to be looking at in the coming 6 to 9 months as it relates to this project?
Well, Dotcom is currently living in New Zealand. His extradition hearing is scheduled for August this year, I believe. And so really the legal wranglings concerning Mega Upload continue. There have recently been some judgments that suggest that the FBI doesn't have to provide various proof that the raids on Dotcom's home were legal, etc., and Dotcom is appealing against that. So there's lots of legal to-ings and fro-ings going on. As I said, also his legal team have recently published a white paper on the website under this heading, the US government versus you, in parentheses, Kim.com. So that is basically what's going on with Dotcom at the moment. For me, the project is developing in a couple of ways. I'm working with a colleague of mine at Middlesex, Dr. Sylvia Shaw, who is a linguist. And what we're looking at is a linguistic analysis of Dotcom's Twitter feed. And we're working on a paper about that together. Obviously, we don't know what we're going to find yet. But after this, what I intend to do is start thinking not just about how Dotcom is presenting himself, but actually how he's received. And that will hopefully get a lot closer to answering a bit more fundamentally, what is the importance of this entire project? You know, what influence is this guy actually having, if any? And how does this relate to political participation more generally? Does it act as an of empowerment? Is that empowerment particularly useful? Is it producing any actual power for the people who are engaging with Dotcom's rhetoric, for want of a better word?
Do you expect to ever meet Dotcom? Would that be part of your research? Or have you talked to people that have met him? How important is that to the work you're doing?
I think in some ways, it's probably very important. At the moment, I don't know how realistic it is. We shall have to see. But I think in some ways, I could be controversial and say it doesn't matter at all. I'm not interested in the actual man because I can never really find out who the actual man is. I'm only interested in his presentation, and therefore I don't need to see him in the flesh. But then by that same token, all identity is performance. So therefore, it's important to see his personal performance as much as his public performance, if that makes sense. Ideally, I think it would make for a much more rounded study to actually get to meet him and interview him. At the moment, I am not quite sure of the practicalities of that, but it's certainly something I'm going to investigate. We shall see whether it's something I manage to achieve or not.
Dr. Virginia Crisp of Middlesex University, London, thank you for joining us today on KZSU-FM and Hearsay Culture. Clearly, .com and Kim.com in particular is not going away. And so I look forward to in having you back on the show if you'd like to continue this discussion. But in the interim, thanks for joining us today. And really, I think filling in many people who are not as familiar as we might expect on this individual and in sharing your research with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm excited to mention for rounding out our spring quarter on KZSU's schedule. I'm looking forward next week to chatting with Ellen Broad of the Australian Digital Alliance, and then rounding out the last week, Susan Chalmers from Internet New Zealand, where I think I'll be following up in this discussion as well. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. This quarter, the show is on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific time on KZSU FM. You can also stream the show live at that time at kzsulive.stanford.edu. And then you can also get the show via podcast, either by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, or by going to the webpage for Stanford CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. After the beginning of June, basically, And this show, again, is being recorded on May 22nd for airing that day. I will be taking a short break during KZSU's interim schedule. And we will resume the show and new shows at the end of June. But in the interim, I do welcome any suggestions you have on guests and any comments and feedback at david@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.